try to being a great communicator.
Right.
Focus on that. It's expressing your feelings, talking to your kids, keeping an open dialogue. And the more you do that, my hunch is when you get to those tougher teenage years, you'll be able to crack through that shell and have an honest conversation.
Welcome to the podcast, Tapping Creativity, with myself, Matthew C. Temple. And each week, we're going to dive into questions and issues and inspiration around creativity and the creative process. Hey, and welcome to this week's episode of Tapping Creativity with myself, Matthew Temple. And I've got a really special guest with us today, perhaps an unusual guest, but as you'll see throughout, the relationship between our guest's work and how he approaches both his life as a writer as well as a father really fits right in with what we like to plumb here on the show. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and introduce author Kendall Smith, whose most recent book is called Rookie Father, a playbook for men experiencing fatherhood for the first time. It is available now. And Smith's work includes self-help, fiction, and satire. He is a dedicated father and husband. All of that is wonderful. He lives in New Jersey. Our hearts go out to him for that. And his core focus is fatherhood and providing relevant, pragmatic advice to new dads. So welcome, Kendall, to the show.
Thanks, Matt. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, this is really great. So, you know, before we got on, one of the things that we were just kind of talking about is an author who wrote a book about fatherhood and what is that relationship to the creative process. And one of the things that I, as I was reading through your book, that sort of dawned on me was that when you sit down to write a book or you sit down to write a screenplay or, you know, compose a score or whatever, you don't have anything there yet. And if you're really engaging in creativity, you're creating something from nothing. So something didn't exist and you create it. And in your case, and actually in all of our cases, I'm a father as well, you were not a father and you know, you may have had some experiences with fathers and you had some ideas of what it is. But the reality is that when you step into that world, you are creating something from nothing. You were once not a father and now you are. You were once inexperienced and as you go, you're sort of developing this new masterpiece of fatherhood. And I just thought that was really fantastic. And I'm even kind of curious how you relate to that as both an author and a writer, but also through how you approached being a new dad.
Yeah, it's an interesting experience because I kind of use the phrase baptized as a father. When you become a father, there's no going back. You have babies don't come with manuals. You've got to figure things out. And the hope is you have a partner there that you can work it out with and you support staff and family and friends to offer advice. But no one's prepared for what you encounter, especially that first year of parenting. It's a wake up call at 4 a.m. and 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. And it's you get run through the ringer that when you first become a father. But again, it's also you're a student from day one when you become a dad. You are learning a whole entire new skill set you've never been exposed to before. And you have to embrace that. You're going to be uncomfortable. And from a right perspective, you know, I try to let their guard down a little bit, to open up their mind to new ideas. And the other thing about fatherhood is when it happens, there's no going back. And you also, your responsibilities magnify. You're in charge for another human being and their life. Your role in the world changes. You know, you'll look at your parents differently. You'll look at your in-laws differently. And if they both want to come over at the same time and hound you and spend time with their grandchildren 6 days a week, it's going to drive you insane. So there's certain things you have to do to help manage the process that you and your wife are both in charge.
So, you know, it's kind of interesting because you say you have to manage that stuff too. Like I said, you know, I have four kids and there's always this demand on your time and there's always something probably that's more important than sitting down and blogging or writing, right? There's always something. And yet you've managed to find time to do that. So like, how is that relationship for you between like, you know, this being and this now new responsibility that you talk about, but also actually honoring that other part of you, which is the creative part of you, the writing part of you.
Yeah. The first year, when after my child was born. I have one son. So compared to you, I'm like a noob over here. You've got four kids. So I can't bitch and moan to you because you've been through it all more than I have. That first year, what I recommend is you take a sabbatical from whatever you're doing. Just focus on your child, learning the skills, growing into the role of being a father. And after that year, then it's time to get back to some of your roots, what you want to do. How I manage it is it's very simple. I set the alarm clock for 5:30 in the morning. I get my pot of coffee going. I'm writing from 5:45 to 7. And that's it. And then I have my day job. I don't do this for a living. I do this out of a passion. So I've got a 9-to-5 corporate job in Manhattan. And when I hit the train or I sit down at my desk, my home office, like I'm dialed into work. So I keep those two. Doing it in the morning, though, frees up my whole day just to get my son to school, be home to catch the ball with him. I'm trying to teach him guitar now, which we'll see how that goes. It's a little tough stretch. It's the hardest thing to teach a child to finger pick a guitar, an acoustic guitar, no less. But by compartmentalizing your writing to a certain part of the day that's off hours, essentially, has freed up my time to do everything else.
That's sort of, I love it. You're just like, oh yeah, it's super easy. You just set your alarm for 5:30 and by 5:45, you're sitting down. God bless you, you know? And and there's really something that came out of that too, which is a really great book. But before we get a little bit more into the book, you've told me a little bit about your process of just kind of getting up in the morning and dedicating that time. One of the things that I appreciate is that you're actually honor that part of yourself to say, you know what, the writer in me is also important. I know that I've gone through periods of my life, and all of us as creatives have, where that part of your life can atrophy. It gets neglected because there's always other things, you know, so it's like this balance, but I think that's, you know, I appreciate that. I want to go back though. I was reading too about you, and you said, so you were a blogger and your rookie dad blog basically, and this is your, you know, exploration fatherhood was really what led to this book. And I'm curious, so as a blogger to author, what was that process like? Like, how many years did it take? Did it just evolve or was there a goal in mind?
Well, I had been blogging on other kinds of subjects for a lot longer before that, some political satire. But when I pivoted, it was almost in unison with the book. And then what I did is I really dove deep. After the book was complete, edited, and I started to pitch it, I went very deep into the blog, blogging 3-4 times a week. And then I was adding, trying to find content to add to it, because there's only so many fatherhood articles you can write. So I love to cook. So I have a section called Chef on there. I have another section called Balls and Chains, which is just tongue in cheek for your better half and managing that relationship. And I started throwing things in there and like, can I fit all this content within the context of rookie father? And I think it works. It's up to the user. And then when the book got picked up, then blogging, it'll still be important, but there's more to do in the short term as far as pitching articles and going out there and trying different things.
What was the process for you of going from, you know, basically writing the book and then pitching it to getting a publisher? Is exciting. And also, I should say, for the publisher, they obviously cared about your book because, like, it's really nicely bound. You know, if you can pet it, it's soft on the covers.
I got to tell you that the publisher, it's Familius, and they're one of the fastest growing small publishing houses in the country. They specialize in children's books. So when they came out with that, they said they were going to add some unique features to it, and I got my hands on it, and I was so grateful. I feel kind of lucky and fortunate. And what I hope I can do for the publisher is continue to build more content and bring fresh ideas to them.
Nice. I promise at some point I'm going to stop connecting this, the writing part and the creative part. But on page 9, talked about trajectory. And I just kind of loved that. Okay, here we go. The mission at hand. Okay, second, keep one single word in mind when these moments occur. This, you're talking about some challenges or whatever. Trajectory. If nothing else, keep the trajectory of your homework and family life on the upswing. If that requires night classes at some point or setting a strict budget to afford tutoring for your child in middle school, do it. Make decisions with a sober mind and communicate consistently with your spouse to ensure you're both on the same page. But this kind of idea of trajectory, I love that both as a parent. I love that both as an author. And this idea that it's not like what's happening right now is not the end of the story. It's a kind of a part of this trajectory. How has that worked for you in all areas of your life, both as a spouse, as a father, as an employee as well, right?
Yeah, you have to have, I think, a little more motivation. And I think you naturally will when you become a father. It's just kind of goes with the territory. People have higher expectations of you. And that's probably a good thing. When you think about your 20s, your 20s are for fun. You have more freedom. You're making some money. You're probably traveling with your buddies. It's like a great time in your life. And if you have a kid during your 20s, that's fine. As you get older, and the U.S. population is having children at an older age now, you know, you should have a rough gauge of where you're going in your 30s, especially when you're a dad. And I'm just going to put that date out there, that age out there. It's flexible. But you have to be looking at, okay, if you're in a house that's too small, how are you going to get there? You need a plan to get there. With your career, you have to manage your career in a way that still gives you quality family time with your wife, with your children. But now it's like, okay, what can I do to better myself? And the other part of that is are there ways for me to earn additional income? Money doesn't buy happiness. Money buys you options. And that is the only thing that comes from money when you think about it. Yeah. And the options, if you have more options in front of you, you can choose a happier path. And getting ahead at work, getting promoted, looking for other opportunities in the same industry if you've hit a glass ceiling per se. It's important to keep what you're going towards and aiming for that. And a lot of that also has to do with financial. Like, you've got to get your retirement going and established after you become a dad. Your son's 529, his college fund. You got to start getting these things in a row. And it doesn't take a ton of money, but you do need to get the foundation there. And when you do, you'll find yourself in 5-10 years in a much better place.
For sure. So in chapter 12, on the anchor of fathers who hold you back. I thought this was really interesting. So you said the use of the word anchor here refers to how ships use anchors to hold themselves in a position, not the talking heads on television. Yeah, okay. As far as an anchor father, I'm referring to fathers who hold themselves and their kids back from the chances to excel in life due to negative influencers. Can you talk about that?
I think it boils down to when you look at the influences in your life. And for those of us, like, I was raised by a single mom. Parents separated when I was 6, divorced when I was 9. And my dad had a drinking problem. And later in life, that essentially it killed him. He died from cirrhosis of the liver. And you're not going to become an alcoholic when you're a dad, and if your dad also drinks. But when you look at different pockets of people, if it's an old friend that keeps coming back, staying the weekend, and gets wasted in your house, like, that's not a place when you're a father. It's not right for the family. If you have a narcissistic aunt that just gets into your head, you need to block and separate if it's required. You need to keep the influences coming into your family as positive as possible. And look, there's people in everyone's personal life that you want someone with bringing a negative influence on a consistent basis into your family life. And you have to guard against that. And it's a little cold, but at the same time, it's what's right for your family, your wife, your child. So yeah. It's a touchy subject, but I put it out there because, you know, my dad lived in Florida. I was in New Jersey. But had he been close and had he been continuing to drink, I would have put up a wall and said, we're going to limit our interaction with you to windows and pockets of time, because that's in the best interest of my child.
Right. Yeah. I started a family very young. My 4 kids are all in college.
Great.
And I'll just... 2 of them are twins, so that was part of the speed at which I accumulated these people, these human beings. I think when you said anchor, the other thing that kind of jumped out at me is not only the people that bring in something negative, but also things that we believe are positive because they are familiar to us. And as an example for me, you know, as a grown up, like, I remember these moments where I was really excited to share certain movies with my daughters. So, like, I loved those movies as a kid. Mm. And I sat down, and then I was like, wait, that in the 1980s, for whatever reason, just really tooted my horn. But in like 2010, it's as though, like, there were these like archaic ways of looking at things that were also familiar, right? So there was a part of me that was like, oh, that's familiar. And I found myself, you know, with my now ex-wife, the mother of my children, and my children was this kind of like pulling back and being like, wait, at what point do I actually have to really question the things that I assumed were good because I had fond memories of them connected to my childhood?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I've lived in that world for years, and it evolves and changes. And you go back and watch the Bad News Bears with Walter Matthau, and there's some zingers in there, man. Like, it is not kosher. It is not the right place to share the kids until they're a little older. I think about Bugs Bunny. I used to love watching Bugs Bunny growing up. And at 4 years old, I showed my son to it, and I kind of like, okay, hit the brakes. We came back to it when he's a little older, can get it. And I would explain, like, you know, you're not supposed to take a hammer and hit it over the head of someone. He goes, yeah, Dad, I know that. Like, obviously. So we got it at that point.
You know, it's so interesting because, yeah, these things that in our lives are these sort of belief systems that when they're comfortable, it feels like it's good, but can also hold us back. And that's true as a father. It's true as a husband. It's true as a, you know, also, you know, as a writer. There's all this kind of like the self-belief stuff, right? These things that I'm pretty sure of or that are just kind of part of my own modus operandi where I'm like, this seems like it's right. It feels comfortable. And yet it's not really serving at the end of the day. And this idea of anchor, and I think it's, you know, I know that it's fairly, you know, the way you said it, but I also think when you bring it up, there's also this nuance, this idea of, you know, being grounded, being held in place, and also a thing that just kind of keeps you from actually being able to move forward. So I think it was a great metaphor.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
You interviewed expert dads throughout, and we get maybe four-ish. I forget exactly now. Yeah. I was too busy petting the book to remember, you know, to remember all those specifics. What is an expert dad?
Well, the first person I interviewed was a gentleman named Dana Glaser, and he is the writer, producer, director of a documentary called The Evolution of Dad. It's a great video. I purposely watched it when I became a father myself because it's just very inspiring. And it showcased stay-at-home dads and how the role of fatherhood, it's much more utilitarian now compared to the 1950s. In the 50s, if you're a dad, you're an earner. And if you're not an earner, you're a bum. And that's basically the philosophy of the society at the time. And the women stayed home. And it's completely blown up and exploded and evolved, which is a good thing. And he profiled and looked at how these men came to be in the house, what they were doing. He was one himself, and that stemmed from his directing career, which was on a great trajectory. One of his movies got shelved, but then he came back to his passion after he had three children. So it's a great story. We have a lot in common. I've known him for years. And he's gone on to do other documentaries as well. And I just loved his passion for parenting. And he just gets into the weeds. He had a great dad. And he has honored him in ways like it's almost like he's the saint of the family. If you talk to him about it, he gets all glowing about it. So I wanted to get his take on it. And then I involved another expert, a guy named Alan Katz. And Alan Katz was a publisher at Condé Nast. And if you know the publishing world, more so in the 80s and 90s, into the aughts as well, Condé Nast was the most powerful publishing house in the country at the time. Vogue, GQ, Wired magazine. I worked for one of his magazines and it was launch called Cargo Magazine. And then I moved on to Wired. He went on to Vanity Fair. And he always had a balance of managing this intense, travel-heavy, socializing work life with his family. And I was just like, I don't know how he keeps it together. I just don't understand. So we dove in to how you manage your work life, how you get into how can you be there for your kids, but also never let your clients down, which is a big part of publishing at the time. And I just like that work-life balance. So he's in there. And then I interviewed two gentlemen that are both dads, married, three kids. They're a town away from me. And I wanted to, you know, nod to progressivism and in respect to the LGBTQ community, I wanted to expose, like, how did two gay dads have kids? How does it happen? What did you do? How do you balance your life? And almost just humanize that part of our society because we're going to start seeing a lot more gay parents with kids. And if you've got an issue with it, you better get over it. And here's just their context so it can be a little more relatable.
Yeah, I love that. I just, when you're saying, you know, an expert dad, I'm like, well, you know, there's this kind of, there's two pieces, right? One, it's like, if you've done a lot of it and you could, you know, you can have, you know, four grown children, it doesn't actually make you an expert dad, right?
Right.
It just means you've done it.
You're never an expert.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to keep learning. I mean, that's the thing. I think the only expert you could find is probably an educator who has six kids and is 7 years old, and like all his kids went to like Harvard or something, and like finding out like what his secret sauce is. But yeah. I haven't found that Harvard guy yet, so yeah. I'll keep looking.
Yeah, and you got to be careful that those six kids at Harvard aren't miserable being there because they really wanted to go stick out their thumbs and travel around the world. But yeah, you know, this it is, and it even one of the coolest things for me was when all of my last kids were 18, and we sat around, and you know, I'd been fairly recently divorced, and. One of my kids had gone off to play baseball in Australia, and then came back, and my twins were graduating high school, and we're all kind of sitting around, and we just had this space to be really honest and vulnerable, and they wanted to share some things with me that had hurt them about things that I had done or mistakes that I had made. And I just had to sit there and really listen and honor. And there were times where I said, well, this is, and I had to be really careful because I wanted to share where I was coming from without it at all seeming like it was an excuse or shirking responsibility. So it was this real delicate balancing act of like, I hear you. And some of the things were like, wait, that was painful for you? I specifically chose to do that because I was sure that was the best thing at that moment. And you're telling me that was really hard for you. And that was, you know, those were some of the challenges. And then to sit around with these adult children and be to receive that they had also taken on some of my own shortcomings, my pathologies, my patterns, things that I, you know, that I would have rather not passed on. And to say, oh, but I have passed those on. And now that's yours. And unfortunately, I can no longer take it away. I can't heal it for you. I can't fix it. I will talk with you. I'll be there. I'll take responsibility anytime you need to talk. And in fact, I want to overcome some of those things too. So I'm happy to be there with you. So when you just said about this thing of continuing to grow, it's like, there's this, like, and I think for some people, I think it's, oh, I've raised my kids and they're going off now. And for me, it was like, oh, it's a whole other level of, oh my goodness. Like this is, there is so much to do now. I got to turn around and say, kids, I want to be a way better person as I move forward. Like it's now your turn to also like, tell me like what didn't work and allow me to be a student in some ways.
Yeah. I think that's incredibly healthy. And I think you should give yourself some credit, Matt, because no matter what you do, every dad, every mom's going to pass off some neuroses or some flaw to their kids. There's no way to encourage or raise a child in a perfect sterile environment, but I think the fact you could acknowledge it and talk about it, that's fantastic. And one of the things in the book that I almost end the book with is a suggestion for dads that when your legacy is thought about, when you've left this world, you know, try to at least leave it with the goal of being a great communicator.
Right.
And if you can focus on that, it's expressing your feelings, talking to your kids, keeping an open dialogue. You know, I've talked to my son numerous times of what it was like to grow up without a dad. And not every day, but I'll pop one in there. So he gets a taste of it because he's got it pretty good. He's an only child. He's got two of us. We just bought essentially our dream house. Like took us like 13 years to get here. And like, it's not a bad area. You know, we're doing okay. Like you should be, whatever you're complaining about, let me tell you. You want a worse story? Sit down. I got a hundred of them. But my point is this, is that I want him to know and I want to be able to communicate that history and that those feelings and emotions. And the more you do that, my hunch is when you get to those tougher teenage years, you'll be able to crack through that shell. Totally. And have an honest conversation, which you probably have experienced. I have not. I'm not there yet. I'm terrified about it, but I'm sure that I think that strategy may work. You tell me though.
Oh, no, for sure. It's setting that foundation for when your kids can actually come to you. The thing, I mean, I can't talk about it publicly at all, but the things that my daughters have come to ask me about, to share with me, I think, you know, 99% of parents would blush and be like, oh my God, I never want to have that conversation with my kids. And yet at the same time, like one of the things that we talked about was so often kids will be like, well, who do you trust? You can go talk to, well, I'm going to go talk to my friends. But your friends, if you're 16, know as absolutely nothing as you do, you're not going to the source of great wisdom and experience when you're going to your 16-year-old friends. And so to kind of like allow it to be like, this is a no judgment zone. We can plumb things. We can have discernment without having judgmentalness, right? We can look and we say that was a pretty dang big mistake and we're not going to praise it. But at the same time, we can also honor that we've all made a lot of mistakes, and mistakes are actually vital to getting anywhere. I think you talk about that too in the book. Like, you're not going to get where you want to go without mistakes. It's the way in which we interact with our mistakes as to whether or not they become, you know, albatrosses around our neck, or whether it actually becomes, you know, the fuel or the, you know, the experience that actually takes us to the next level.
Yeah. And when I pen Rookie Father, a big thing I have learned is you have to admit to your mistakes. You're going to screw up. Yep. And if you repeat the same pattern a mistake and you anticipate a different outcome, there's a definition for that, and that's insanity. So you're gonna make mistakes, just accept it and grow from it. I made one the other night. I've got a guitar in my background here, and I play it very, very casually. I'm more of a drummer. My son wants to play guitar, and I'm showing him what to do, and he was just like struggling with it. I'm like, oh, come on, just man through it. Like, come on, you can try this. And it was the wrong approach. It turned him off. And I sat there, and I half an hour later, I'm like, okay, I got to go back. And son, I made a mistake and I apologize. And nothing more humbling than apologizing to an 8-year-old. but you got to just, man, you got to admit your mistakes.
Absolutely. There were a couple of other chapters in here that anybody who reads them, I want to just kind of like point out. There was chapter 56, where you actually talked about your expectations in your child's life. And I just thought that's so important, because even when you just said like, oh, you know, the guy with the secret sauce whose kids all went to Harvard, it's like those become our expectations. And you said this thing, and I just think this is so important, both for as parents, but also when we look at ourselves, because we are also children and somebody else parented us, and we're dealing with, I mean, you know this, you've written this book in part because you dealt with the failures of your father. In order to become the man you are now and the father you are today. And so when you kind of look at how am I being with my child, am I going to dig these deep grooves and tell them to like slide in? Or am I going to give these kind of gentle grooves that actually allow them also this freedom? And relating that also back to ourselves is that, where have we kind of put ourselves into these deep grooves? And how do we balance that everywhere we are in our lives as children ourselves, and then parents of the children coming up behind us.
Yeah. I think that's a good point is the expectations. And it's funny you mentioned channels, and you probably were referencing the book, but I talk about like, give them a little nudge, see what happens, see where their passion takes them. And it'll carve itself like the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon. Their interest will take them, and then just be there to support them. I mean, I'm lucky because we have friends that their children love hockey and hockey practice. Is it 5 a.m. in the morning, three days a week? So I'm like, God bless you. I don't know how you manage that. That's tough. But that's the requirement. It doesn't last forever. But
Kendall, I think that the other little piece of advice that we could give you and parents is don't start any groove that has to do with ice hockey. Just no grooves there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes fatherhood and this process can feel very, very mundane, you know, and it's like not necessarily sexy, whether it's the mistakes or it's the exhaustion or it's the all these other things. And I just thought that also relates. I loved reading this because it was just this wonderful reminder of how much my process of being like a young father was related to how I ended up becoming a writer and a filmmaker in my life, was that it's a creative process, and that the creative, you know, when you sit down to write at 5:30 or 5:45, as soon as the coffee's done brewing, that's not sexy. That's like, that's mundane. That's like the bags are still under your eyes. You're like, oh, you know, you stayed up and watched an extra episode of something on Netflix, and now you're really dragging in the morning. That shit ain't sexy. Yeah. And yet that's also when the love is in the, not the outcome of, oh, my kid is, you know, has now been accepted with a full ride into God knows where, but that is like the end, or, hey, you know, I've got this, you know, fantastic book that was published by this wonderful publisher and I'm super proud of it. But really being a writer is at 6 o'clock in the morning with bags under your eyes. Being a dad is, you know, it's those moments. And there was this time, my daughters all played baseball, and I remember I took them to practice one day, and there was this one of the kids on their teams, the grandmother was always the one taking them and doing all that stuff. And I said, oh, so you're the one who has to like do all the chauffeuring and the dirty work. I made some sort of joke like that. And she goes, no, this is the best part.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. The advice that I've written to Rookie Father, this is a collection of everything I've learned. Other dads, growing up observing, like this is, these are things I found that when I put them into practice, they were incredibly effective, but it's applicable and it's actionable. And it's not a superfluous theory of how you should raise your children. And it's not 30-page chapters, it's 1 to 2 page chapters. But back to the book, the two things that I wrote about was, actually one's on my blog, is you only get 18 summers with your kids. That's it.
Yep.
Make them count. And then another friend who's a phenomenal father, an educator in the New York City public school system, he talked about periods of a child's life, going from 1 year old to 2 and then crawling between 2 and 3. And he said, you never get these moments back. They will come, they will go. And if you miss it, if you're working too much, if you're traveling too much, you will literally miss them and you don't want to. And that kind of – that stuck with me like glue. And I feel fortunate. I feel fortunate that COVID, I've been home for almost 2 whole years now.
Amazing.
And I've seen literally watch this child grow inch by inch. And it's like what we've had together, and even before that, but especially the last 2 years, is more time than I spent with my father in my entire life. It's just insane how much we have. And I think it's going to actually change and evolve fatherhood itself. I think dads now are kind of a little, will be considered a little more in the fold in their own mental state and physical state.
Yeah, I like to think of this as like it's that when fathers realize that, wait a second, this whole social narrative of women stay at home and be with the kids and the dads go out, like we got a short end of the stick too. Like, I want to be with my kids. This is the good stuff, right? I love it.
Yeah.
Well, Kendall, this has been so fantastic. You know, I really appreciated, your insight. And even as a not rookie father myself, I found the book really just insightful and fun and well-written. I certainly learned some new things and got new insight and just love it. And for anyone who's thinking about becoming a father, if you are one and you need it and you don't have a lot of time because you're trying to find time to write or do something else, literally, as Kendall said, like 1 to 2 page chapters, put it on the back of the crapper, right in the middle of, you know, the second S, you can go ahead and get a whole lot of important wisdom about fatherhood. It's out now. Highly recommended, beautiful book. And Kendall, thanks so much for joining this afternoon.
Pleasure talking to you, Matt. Thanks so much.